folks, and welcome to Dungeon Casters, this Dungeon Master Advice Show for Rookie DMs by Rookie DMs.
I'm Ben.
And I'm Scott.
And we're here to help you run your campaign
for an election in 2020.
Ooh, topical podcast.
This week, we're talking about etiquette. We're talking about tabletop etiquette, role-playing etiquette, creative etiquette. Also, I'm not dead.
Yeah, Scott's not dead. So, I understand that there may be a continuity issue here because I told you, the lovely public, that Scott had died in a skateboarding accident. I was misinformed. He didn't.
Though reports say I did get a pretty gnar boo-boo, so I got that to deal with.
Well, that's what happens when you get bombed out by, like, a World War II plane, Scott. You get a gnar boo-boo.
Yep. All
yeah.
right.
Yeah.
So, with etiquette, there's a couple things we want to talk about, but the first things I want to mention are something I've been saying, you know, for a while throughout the season, and it's something that Ben said initially when we were first brainstorming way early in our podcast, and I think it's the most apt description of etiquette in role-playing, and the idea is intent and respect. So when you are doing anything and you're wondering if it's okay, if this is, you know, cool to say, or this is cool to do, or if this is problematic or whatnot, the important thing to remember is, what is the intent, and is that intent respectful?
Yep. All right. Everyone's allowed to make mistakes, obviously. Like, mm-hmm. we all misstep, that's fine. You know, I didn't mean to, I apologize. But there's also, I think, when you're running a game for a group of people, especially a game that's as socially oriented as this one, where there's no scapegoat if you mess up. It's not like you can say, oh, the game sort of, I know it's not great, but the game, for whatever reason, presented this kind of complicated, problematic thing to me. There's just you. And so if you misstep, all that is on you. And sometimes that's easily solved with just, sorry, won't happen again. I didn't mean to. And sometimes it's not that simple, and that can get mm-hmm. very awkward. And
yeah.
And so there is this issue of intention and respect. I would urge everybody to go in with the best of intentions. Don't intend to offend. I know there's people who, God, they just love doing that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't personally get that mentality. I'm not sure what joy you might get out of setting people. That doesn't make sense to me. I would urge everybody to go in with the intention, at least, of providing a fun, inviting environment at your game, and to be as respectful as possible, to consider carefully, at least, or at least briefly, the makeup of the people in front of you and the makeup of people in general, and say, is this respectful to do this or that? And we'll get into specifics. And if you do flub, to be respectful even after that point. It's not about defensiveness. It's about accepting that sometimes you make mistakes, other people make mistakes, things go awry, and that we can move on in a healthy way. You know, you just say, like, whoop, my bad. Like, we're going to change that. That's not what I'm trying to do.
Exactly. And, like, one of the key parts about etiquette in regards to tabletop gaming is making your table an open, welcoming place for anyone sure. who may be there. And I'm going to, you know, caveat this episode and give a little disclosure in the beginning, or a little,
Disclaimer.
Disclaimer, that's the word I was looking for. Surprise, Ben and I are two straight white males.
Hi. You've probably never seen anything like us before. We're very new, but we think we have a shot.
And we're gonna, you know, say that we are doing our best, to the best of our understanding. We're going to try to explain these things openly and with as much, you know, respect and without being white savory, male savory, straight savory,
or anything else like that.
But the main point I look into for tabletop etiquette is making a welcoming table for whoever may be there. And even if a certain demographic is not sitting at your table that night, that doesn't mean all of a sudden, like, whoop, gloves are off, this person's not here tonight, so I get to be fucked up and bigoted. It's the kind of thing where it's something that you should consistently display in your regular life, and that should also come into role-playing. Like, just because you're playing a role-playing game and you're stepping into a character doesn't mean that that gives you an excuse to, like, let out all of that pent-up racism that you have to bottle up in public. You still have an obligation to be a good human being while you're role-playing.
Yes, exactly. And I was saying before we started that there's even maybe more of an obligation to do it in the context of Dungeons & Dragons, or I guess any RPG, really, for a few reasons. One of those reasons is the hobby has a very sordid past when it comes to acceptance and respect and diversity and things like that. And this is... Finally, it's coming to a point where the public version of the game is diversifying. I think very likely there have been women who've been playing for a long time, and people from all groups that have been playing for a long time, but for a large period of time, the only sort of public version was a pretty kind of nasty version of things. Some years ago, I did a large paper on sort of role-playing as a psychological and social interaction, things like that. And I'm not claiming to be an expert on any of this by any means. But I read a number of books about games and psychology, and specifically role-playing games on some of them. And some of the things I read, the sort of power fantasies, the nastiness, like the social, the unshackling, you know, that would kind of happen, was vicious. And like, I was reading things that, you know, it was kind of a truth is stranger than fiction moment where I was like, nobody, who would have said this with somebody around with a tape recorder? And it was really kind of fine. And I'm only talking about like the late 80s. I'm not saying like, oh, this is like back when it was, you know, like the early 70s. It was like just starting, and it was just a bunch of like gruesome. I mean, this was, the game had been around for like 10, 15 years. And this was like, this book went through into the 90s and so like the early 90s. And I was like, boy, howdy. Things were rough. And I think finally we are at a point where enough people the game has diversified. And I think Wizards has made a great effort to do that. But still the game has some, God, just hangers on of like the very specific sort of segregated ways that they used to be.
Well, and that's the thing with any, you know, subculture at all, regardless of if it is a hobby subculture, a music subculture, a activity sub, like whatever kind of subculture, there's always going to be people like that. There's always going to be people that want to make it exclusory. There's always going to be people that want to stick things to the status quo. And when anything starts to change, they panic. And that's where a lot of backlash you get. In D&D, historically, against women has been the big one. And, like, there's plenty of sociological and cultural implications that I could probably talk about that I'm definitely not equipped or proficient enough in any kind of knowledge to talk about, so I'm going to kind of skip them today.
That was a Dungeons & Dragons way to phrase that. Like, I'm not proficient in the skills, like, enough to say.
I'm not proficient in sociology knowledge. I'm not proficient in anthropology knowledge. Or cultural studies, so I'm just going to go ahead and skip it for today. But, like, it's the thing is, you have a lot that you as a player or you as a DM can do to change these things. Yeah. And I feel like the overwhelming problem is that the loudest voices are people who are dissenters or people who are attractors, in the sense of like people who want change and people who don't want change are the people that are screaming at the top of their lungs. And then the 60-70% of everyone else are the people that are silent.
I mean, most people are like, I'm not getting into it. But it is important, and I know that some people are going to be like, like, what is this? This what? Tell me about warlocks. But I think that Scott and I had a somewhat tricksy conversation going into this about the importance of this at the gaming table, and the more I think about it, the more the importance of this to me, beyond the sort of grandeur of the game and its history and the current social climate, in at least in America, is that it, for me, I enjoy the game, and I want other people to enjoy the game.
Exactly.
And because I enjoy it, I want to share that with anybody else who will even be remotely interested.
Oh, right? My
like
God.
It brings me joy to be like, when somebody's like, that seems really cool, what are you doing? And I'm like, oh, hell yeah. Like, get over here. It's so joyful to me. Even if I'm not, if I never play with that person, just to be like, I'm going to give you something that I find, precious in a way.
Yeah.
You know, no, something I find a great deal of joy in, a hobby that is dynamic and social and intricate or fun, just simple if you want it to be, really modular in a lot of ways, you know, pick up and go when you need it, you can spend a lot of time on it, all these kinds of things, and to give that to somebody is really important. And so etiquette comes in here where if you want to present it to somebody, you have to be aware of that's of who that somebody is. And just because, you know, you think this is interesting or fun or fine doesn't mean they will, and it breaks my heart when I see people who are interested who get immediately turned away. Not because, oh, this is too complicated, I don't think I could spend the time, or, oh, actually, I'm not really into fantasy enough, but because, I mean, how many times have you and I talked to people who have said, yeah, the game really interests me, but the first time I played, I had such a bad experience with the people around me that I haven't even thought about trying it again for about 10 years.
It's of that, the amount of women I have spoken to who played the game back in the day and were forced into a seductress-esque role and forced into this, you know, high fantasy power nerd trope of, like, being this, like, sexy, busty seductress, and that's all women are capable of doing in Dungeons & Dragons.
Yeah.
It fucking drives me up a wall, because these are human beings that could have been really rad role players, and it also could have been more people that I could have been playing D&D with that will never touch the fucking game because some lonely, shitty nerd in high school wanted to play out a rape fantasy and wanted a real woman there for it.
Yeah, it's an unfortunate part of it, and I know that people are maybe not, I mean, maybe everybody's on board with us at this point, but if there are people who find this, like, what is this doing here, you know, like, this isn't what this is about, I've spoken to people who don't, who somehow so, what is the word, they separate the game from real life. They have found it a way. They have found a way to completely divorce themselves from anything they do in game.
Yeah.
And I want to say that even in the scenario where, you know, because what's the defense here? It's like, well, what, I rolled a completely random character, the completely random background. I went on like a character generator, and they gave me a backstory and characteristics. Like, I'm following what I was given. Like, I don't want to be like a horrible person, but that's what I'm doing because I said I'd roll randomly, and I'm obeying that rule. It's not my fault I got, you know, womanizer, or I got like hates this group of people, you know, not offensive, you know, rude, you know, vulgar, you know, it's not my fault. And I want to say to that is, well, you're right in that you didn't choose those things outright. You didn't elect that necessarily in that scenario. However, choosing to play that character, be it as a DM and you're doing that character, or as a player where you're playing that character out, you elected to, first and foremost, ignore possibly the people in your immediate group and almost certainly potential players that will come in from the outside that you aren't certain about yet. You've decided that even though you didn't choose it, and maybe you accept in some way that it might be a problem and that it might not be like a great person to be, you're still willing to do it. We said we wouldn't tell any anecdotes, and I want to say outright, this is nobody in our group of people. This is somebody like I briefly met at like college, like years ago. Mm-hmm. Somebody who played a really nasty sort of, this character like beat women, like that was their thing. And I remember saying something like, does that not strike you as kind of, well, for lack of a better word, like fucked up, like that you would do that, especially because there were several women in the group, one of whom was his girlfriend. And I was like, does this not bother anybody? He's like, well, it's not me, it's my character. I said, yeah, but you still had to decide that this would be fine, funny, acceptable, not a problem, that it would be comfortable for the people. I mean, you had to go through so many things to decide that you were going to do this. And you could have just re-rolled and said, maybe that's not a great idea. Maybe somebody's like not going to be so cool with that, and I don't need to just do that. I mean, I don't know why you would want to participate in something with somebody like that.
Yeah, well, and here's the thing, is like, it would literally be impossible to list off like, hey, this is a problem, this yeah. isn't, because that's ridiculous, and also everything's a fucking gray area, so it doesn't sure. matter, but like, I don't know, I feel like every human being has at least a basic sense of morality that they could understand, like, hey, maybe if I'm going to be, you know, role-playing or, like, hanging out with a bunch of women in general, talking and rising up and, like, idealizing someone who beats women is not a good idea. Like, right. it's real fucking kindergarten bullshit that, like, that people should know better. And, like, the excuse of, oh, it's not me, it's my character, I'm just role-playing, is a load of garbage. Yeah. Because even if, like, that whole scenario of someone randomly rolling their character, if you have a shred of, you know, morality within you, you can understand, like, well, hey, maybe I'm going to roll this one again because this is going to end up being fucked up. Also, there are ways to play, like, there's no way you can roll a random character with the D&D built system and come up with a problematic character. Like, yeah, womenizing is, like, a trait that could be seen as problematic, but also could be role-played in a not-problematic way. So, like, anything as specific as, like, he beats women as one of his things, that's not something from Wizards of the Coast, that's not something they randomly generated, yeah. that's something they thought about and chose and wanted to role-play.
Yeah.
And so, like,
That was kind of the big issue. Yeah, it was like, you didn't pull this out of a book. You thought, like, wouldn't this be a gag? It's like, I guess? I don't know what to say to that, other than don't.
Yeah.
I want to throw a little, like, asterisks on this for a second. And I want to say that I, and I think probably we, fully understand that sometimes in a character's backstory, it's like, I hate this group of people because they did something. You know, like, there's tons of, like, you know, one of the canonical things in the game is that, like, half-orcs come from orcs who have, like, raped women of this or that race, right? And they've mm-hmm. had babies that way. I suppose it could work the other way. I think if you go back, it wasn't that way. Maybe they've changed things around so it's not quite so, like,
vulgar,
violent. Yeah. But let's just say we're playing an old version of the game and, like, that's the thing. So you say, like, well, I hate orcs because I'm an outcast in society because of them. And it's like, well, yes. But the important part of that is, like, orcs aren't real. You know, it's like a book where somebody hates vampires. It's like, yeah, I mean, the sort of caustic emotion involved in that might be very human. You know, it might be totally, I mean, maybe not with vampires, but with you know, elves yes. or something. You might have an emotion that's kind of irrational, is definitely on the, like, the racism spectrum, is just hateful and horrible and results in violence sometimes. But it's also a story in which it's like, well, it's tricky, but if an elf shows up, we'll cut it out. You know, it's like, you're dealing with things that aren't even real at that point. And so the emotion, tricky to work with.
Yeah.
But it's not, it's directed at a sort of an intangible, unreal entity. And so in that way, if your character is really, you want the arc, if that's what you see your character as, somebody who is full of hatred for something, and through the efforts of this adventure, they will come to terms with that hatred. They will relieve themselves of it. They will do. That's a very dramatic arc. And I wouldn't want people to necessarily say, oh, I can't have this kind of arc because it's going to be horrible. Because I think that is a dramatic arc. And in a setting where you have so many, like, wild creatures, like, you can have that kind of arc without actually having to be like, oh, I'm aggressive towards a group of people that are totally real, if not in this room. Because yeah. It's like, who wants to sit there and be insulted?
Well, exactly. And this is the thing, is like, that's the important aspect to remember about D&D, is that it is a fantasy world. So
yeah.
When you're doing this stuff and when you're dealing with this stuff, the gray areas come up. But like, I don't know, if your character was a half-orc and thus hates full orcs because of the, you know, implied narrative with their origins, yeah. Like, okay, that's fine if that's going to be the character, but that doesn't mean, like, you get to reskin real-life racist phrasing and sayings and shit that, like, the KKK actually says and just switch out a specific race with orc. Like,
yeah.
It doesn't mean you get to rebrand actual racism for your character. It has to have very different implications. And, like, We talk a lot about how freedom is important, how creativity is important, and how, like, you shouldn't limit yourself with a lot of these rules and these walls and everything. But, like, this is a situation in which, like, suck it up and limit yourself.
Yeah, really.
Like, you don't need, like, I'm not crushing your creative freedom by telling you you can't be a racist wife beater in my D&D campaign. Like,
yeah.
That's not me, you know, taking a shit on your creative dreams. That's me stopping you from being an asshole.
Yeah.
Again, like, Ben and I talked about this beforehand. We don't want to do specific anecdotes or specific stories because we don't want to, you know, like, blow up anyone's spot. Even if we don't use names, we don't want to, like, you know, it's just, like, an uncomfortable kind of situation to talk about, but, like, some general examples of, like, problematic stuff that I have heard about, known about, or experienced, the most simple one and the easiest one to stop is just sometimes people use, oh, my character is mean as a excuse to be able to bully another person that they're role-playing with that they don't like. This is something that I have experienced where someone saying, like, oh no, my character's just, like, an asshole. That's their, you know, character trait. And so, they're really mean specifically to one other player character, and then I happen to know in real life that those two player characters do not get, like, the human beings controlling those characters don't get along.
Yeah.
That's the kind of stuff where it's a DM's obligation to be like, alright, either put this shit aside or get away from my table. Yeah. Like, stuff like that.
Yeah.
I got pretty heated before when I was talking about the example in regards to, you know, forcing women into a very specific sexually based power dynamic role.
Mm-hmm.
That is something that I've also, as I said, multiple times heard from different human beings that that's happened to them. So
yeah,
there's that. But I think, like, the bottom line is, like, these kind of things are things to watch out for, things to be careful about, and things to, you know, acknowledge, but they shouldn't be the focus of any D&D campaign. Sure. And, like, they shouldn't be something that comes up as often as they seem to, in regards to, like, Dungeons & Dragons is a fantasy role-playing game where you fight dragons and monsters and, like, you know, shoot bows and arrows and cast magic spells.
Yeah.
Being a fucking racist wife beater is not something that should be on the radar there.
Yeah, like, I know what you mean. I mean, and I understand that it. God, what am I even trying to say here? I understand that at some point, if it gets down to ground level, there's characters, people in the world who are not nice people. But it's also, you have to consider this from, if only from a narrative perspective, is that if this were a book, I would think most people wouldn't want that particular character to succeed. You'd kind of want them to fall in a volcano at some point.
Exactly.
Or something, or you wouldn't want them to stay that way. Like I said, like, it's a dramatic arc. You know, it's sort of like a... God, was American History X like this? I can't remember the end of the movie enough.
So yeah, American History X, the idea of, like, the militant Nazi skinhead, like...
Yeah.
Starting to realize that he's fucked up and, like, his whole viewpoint is wrong.
Yeah.
And, like, trying to change
it. It's a dramatic arc, but also it is an arc that, like, a lot of people are not going to want to sit around for at the table. I mean, like, how miserably uncomfortable is that going to be? Unless it's handled so delicately that at that point, probably just pick something else, you know?
Yeah.
And I just...
I cannot imagine
I'm sorry, I cut you off. Go ahead.
I just can't imagine a point where, like, that is such a necessary character trait for your character to exist that you can't just, like, you know, suck it up and pick something else.
I think you made a good point with it's a game about, like, fighting dragons and casting spells and flying on invisible discs and turning into sheep and you know, breaking goblins over your knee and stuff. And so if you've gotten to a point where characters are like abusing each other, I don't know, something went wrong somewhere in the whole operation of it. People have in that case used that game for a very different reason than to gather and have fun playing a game.
Exactly. And so I want to switch gears a little bit.
Yeah.
And kind of move.
I don't want to beat this dead horse forever.
Yeah, because I feel like we have made our point. But I want to start talking about etiquette in the sense of interaction around the table.
Sure.
So one of the things that I notice oftentimes when DMing is experienced players will take the reins. New players will be too nervous to speak up or do anything. And sometimes people are content to just go along for the ride,
sure.
But I think that it's, and we talk about how, you know, players are narcissists and they all want the spotlight on them all the time.
So true.
Yeah, well, we're both players and we're both the same way, so it works
so
out.
So true.
but, like, here's the thing, it's, like, a piece of etiquette that's, like, a little bit less serious, a little bit less of, like, a grim kind of thing is, like, being accepting and welcoming to new players or being accepting and welcoming to shy players. And as, you know, someone sitting around the table, make it a point to be like, sure, my character is bombastic and they talk a lot and they take the reins and they're very like headstrong and courageous and stuff. But also acknowledge that you're not the only person playing. So there are other people there that would like a turn. And like, as childish as that phrasing is, it's important to share the time with other people.
I don't think it's childish at all. I think it's just simple. And I think that it can be very easy to get wrapped up in the excitement of the game or just the excitement of hanging out with people you like hanging out with and forget that, especially in the case where you have a new player, it is courteous, if nothing else, to every once in a while as a fellow player, you know, pose a question to them. Give them a directed and called out opportunity to engage the conversation. Because, like, you know, as a new player myself and as a sort of selectively shy person, not every time I get into a group of people, I want to speak at all. Sometimes I want to speak only when sort of called upon, and sometimes I'm fine with speaking whenever. So if you have a player who is that shy, maybe in general, but who is, if nothing else, just new and maybe doesn't even really know the people playing with them that well, it is important, and we'll get to DMs, but it's important as a player to remember that and every once in a while pose them questions and say, like, well, what do you think? Like, what do you think we should do? What's your opinion on this? What's your plan? And maybe even just, you know, as a sort of, I don't know, sense of camaraderie, you know, everybody sort of gets a turn planning the next phase. You know, it's like, well, I planned how we got in. How do we steal the thing? Well, you planned how we steal the thing. How do you think we should get out? You know, I mean,
yeah. And I mean, and this is the thing, is like a lot of D&D sessions and a lot of games are a discourse. They're a dialogue where, like, they're like, no, we shouldn't do it this way. We should do it that way. Yeah. And you spend an hour and a half planning. And that's a part of D&D. It's something that ideally would not happen that much. But, like, honestly, it happens to everyone all the time. And the important thing is, like, as one of the more experienced players in the group we run to, and someone who is, you know, famous for being a rules lawyer, famous for having, like, a really deep knowledge of the game, there are a lot of times where I start to talk and then stop myself. Yeah. And I literally stop myself and sit back and do not talk. Because, yes, I might know exactly what we're facing, exactly how to fix it, exactly the right thing to do, but, like, my character might not. First off, my character I'm playing might not. And so in that case, you know, you got to think about, like, well, would my 7 intelligence half-orc barbarian really know that beholders have a cone of anti-magic in front of them? No, probably not. No, like, probably not. I know that.
They would believe they were floating on a series of invisible strings.
Well, and that's the thing, is, like, it's like, okay, so, you know, my player wouldn't know, my character wouldn't know that, so I'm not going to tell our wizard not to cast spells in front of the beholder with his anti-magic field, because I wouldn't know that information.
Yeah.
Also, like, it's really easy for experienced people who've been doing this for a while, because it's a game that builds with momentum, the love for the game builds with momentum, the more you play, the more you want to, so you want to get into that and, like, bite into the game and really play hard, but with a new player, that first step is hard. And so sometimes it's important to facilitate it as a player, because the DM can't fucking do everything.
No, the DM can't, and I do think that experienced players have a responsibility. I mean, you know, you're not obligated. Like, you know, not saying, like, you have to take them under your wing and be a good sport, because, like, you're not obligated. Like, if the game to you doesn't really, you don't get any joy out of doing it, you know, whatever, I get it. You don't have to be courteous, you don't have to be hand-holding. But I agree that to some point, you have to have a general awareness of who around you has spoken, who around you has had opportunities, who around you might be feeling left out, and what in the moment, like you said, like, your character might know something, but you might not. Your character might know something, but you actually might not, or vice versa. You might know something your character does not. And that's an important piece of etiquette, because sometimes people blurt out things and they do things and you go, like, I don't know if you would have known that or thought to do that. That was a little out of context, and we all slip up. But that's part of it, too, is sort of keeping a slow, conscious awareness of you and your surroundings. But I think you make a good point that sometimes it's best to, when you start to speak and you're second guessing it for a moment, sometimes it's better to not, sometimes it's better to say, I'm going to hang back for this one. And if it comes up, I will sort of go there. I don't think enough people do that in general. They stop themselves from just blathering on the second they have something to say. I think that the game, especially depending on how large your party is and how diverse your party is in terms of A, experience level, and B, people who, like, know each other and to what degree, taking that moment to pause is important, because otherwise you get this sort of just ungodly, clamorous, impossible to parse sound
And here's the thing with that, where, like, as what happens on a lot of casual gaming tables, and you might notice a lot less on professional gaming tables in the sense of, you know, podcasts or live streams or Twitch streams or whatever, yeah. Is people arguing over their next action in a very specific sense.
Mm-hmm.
Where someone has an idea or an intuition or an insight, and people will be like, no, you're wrong, it's this, and the third person will be like, well, actually, both of you are idiots, and it's this.
Yeah.
You see on, like, in that professional setting, we talked about this the couple weeks ago with the improv, yes anding. So, mm-hmm. like, as an experienced player, one of the best things to do to make the game fun, engaging, and, like, because, like, sure, you might not perfectly 100% complete this dungeon and, like, not take damage while you're doing it and get all the trophies and achievements or whatever, but, like, it'll make it a more fun, interesting story is yes anding. So, like, yeah. When we were in the library, we were talking about a couple weeks ago, and there was this book monster that Ben just pulled out of his ass, and someone said, shh, be quiet, you have to be quiet in libraries, and that's the librarian. Like, that was a character taking a wild guess, and everybody ran with it, and it was really, really cool and really fun. So, like, allowing for that kind of stuff to happen... And, like, that doesn't mean you have to be quick draw McGraw on all of your theories and be the first person to blurt something out of your mouth, so yeah. That's what you do. Yeah. But, like, it's kind of where you get into the DM's territory, where, like, oftentimes if someone says some shit like that, I will just be like, all right, roll an insight, roll an intelligence, roll a wisdom or something like that to see if they're right. And if they roll well, I'll be like, I'll tell the other players, like, that seems... seems pretty accurate. Mm-hmm. Or if they roll really poorly, I won't address the person who's rolling, I'll address the other people, and I'll say, like, that doesn't sound like something that's true. So, the person that rolled believes the thing they said in character. The yeah. other people, that's what their role decides, is if the rest of the party believes them or not. So yeah. It's the kind of thing where, you know, you can, as a DM, step in and use game mechanics as kind of a statistics wall to stop them from arguing and stop them from going beyond that. I also think that as a DM, and I feel like you were going to touch on this before, with those new players, it's very important to specifically include them by name.
Yeah.
And, like, alright, so, you know, Ben's a new player in my campaign, and he hasn't talked all night, and his character has just kind of been, like, along for the ride. So next time they're faced with something, I'm like, all right, Ben, you're in the front. What do you do? Mm-hmm. And Ben looks to the other players to see what they're going to tell him to do, and then you're like, no, Ben, what do you do?
Yeah.
And you force them to make a decision for the party. And as soon as someone's made a party decision, they're in it. There's no turning back from, like, all right, I decided something that altered our fate. So now, like, I am involved in this, and I can't backseat it anymore.
I agree. I agree with everything you said. Next question.
Okay.
I think, too, I want to make this point, is in any given group, you'll have at least one, but sometimes several, strong personalities. And while they're a great asset to any group because they keep things moving, they keep things lively, often their characters are, they get themselves into trouble because they're really audacious because they tend to make audacious kinds of characters. As those people, it behooves the group to be aware of that and to restrain it just a little bit, again, for the sake of those who take a more passive role for one reason or another. And I kind of wanted to say that there's been this huge resurgence of popularity in D&D, right? In the recent, like, God, year, 2 years, couple years.
I don't even know if it's technically a resurgence because it's never been as popular as it is.
Yeah, so this flowering, you know, just this blossoming. Aww, of the
that's
game.
A pretty
it's,
way.
It's pretty, right? It's adorable. Yeah. The Dungeons and Dragons flower. So... What that's meant is, and I think that's very cool, right? I think there's podcasts I've liked, you know, and I'm so excited to be able to go on Twitter and there's just like a bazillion people I'm at Dungeons & Dragons all the time, and I have a great amount of fun watching YouTube channel after YouTube channel that go over Dungeons & Dragons stuff. I think that's great. I also have noticed that, especially with like the podcast stuff and the videos, the recorded sessions, like, you know, I remember the first one I ever saw was the Penny Arcade, the PAX live ones. And I was wow, this is like so rad. They're having so much fun. This is so funny. And part of that's just because, you know, those guys are very funny people. But it led to, I mean, it didn't directly lead to, but let me phrase it this way. All these things, right? These live shows, these podcasts, these whatevers, they oftentimes aren't exactly what Dungeons & Dragons actually looks like at the table. Mm-hmm. They all are done within these very specific parameters to make it as entertaining and as smooth as it is, right? It's kind of like porn in that way. But, like, so you take the PAX East, you know, the Penny Arcade things. If you've never seen them, they're about 2.5 hours long. They're the initially it was three of the guys who worked for Penny Arcade, the internet comic, and Will Wheaton. And then Will Wheaton sort of transitioned out. Morgan Webb from G4 TV was there for a while. And now it's
Patrick Rothfuss,
the fantasy author. Yeah. He's been a more permanent addition. And now they have like a million little shows on the Penny Arcade website. They're about 2.5 hours, and they're like these one shots with the same characters. And,
Perkins DM.
And Chris Perkins, one of the head designers for Dungeons & Dragons, is their DM. So like obviously everything's super cohesive. So they like run really smoothly, and they're really good, and they're funny, and they're just these madcap sort of like, this is crazy. And it's like, I want to have a game like that. I want to play Dungeons & Dragons, and that's great. I'm glad they're inspiring. But with those, you have to remember, they have a strict 2.5 hour time limit. They're basically non-sequitorial, well, semi-sequitorial one-shots. You have the DM is one of the leading designers of the game, so he has to reference nothing when he plays, basically.
Yeah.
And you have the added pressure of a live audience that wants to sort of see what happens, right? So the people who play know they have to move the story forward. And usually they have one or two people there who are actively doing that. Usually like Jerry Holkins will be the one who's like, all right, like, but what do we do? While the other ones kind of goof around a little bit. So it's like, well, yes, they're having a lot of fun within like extremely tight confines, right? Strict time limit, very specific DM, live audience, you know, all these things. And then you have the podcasts. Like I was a big fan of The Adventure Zone, which is the McElroys, who are part of Polygon, and their father. And Scott's a big fan of God's Fall.
Oh my God.
And there's Critical Role, obviously, that's one of the biggest ones. But you have to understand that those two all fall within these very specific parameters. You have the Adventure Zone, while they are not like professional players, I guess, they edited the living shit out of those episodes, right? There's a lot of stuff taken out of each one of those episodes to make it as streamlined as it is.
Mm-hmm.
Also, two of the McElroy brothers, Justin and Griffin, have been doing YouTube videos together for a very long time, so they're very versed in how to engage with people in that format, or at least roughly that format, and their father was a radio DJ. So, there's a lot of things going on there that people know how to talk to each other in this group. And they know when to stop, and they know how to phrase things, and they know how to keep things moving because they know that they have to. And with God's Fall, as you've told me, it's a very heavily edited show and a very heavily scripted show in a lot of cases.
It's, and that's the thing, is like, Aram Vartian is the DM and kind of it's his brainchild, and his whole idea when he started it was creating the highest production value Dungeons & Dragons podcast. So he goes as far as to edit, specific sound clips in, like when someone scores a hit with their sword, there is a clang of a sword hitting armor. When someone, like, there's music consistently, the background music when they walk inside switches from like the sound of a babbling brook and like flutes to like the din of an inn or a tavern. Like, he puts hours and hours and hours into editing these episodes, and also like his commitment was shown for a while. I don't know what his the current situation is, but I know last I checked, he was recording in Washington, D.C., but he lives in Chicago. So he was flying out to D.C. to record with the voice actors, with the players in his campaign, and then coming home to Chicago and editing it for hours and hours and hours. And Critical Role, they're all professional voice actors.
So like, every single one of them is familiar with having these sorts of conversations with each other and knowing when to shut up. And so, I you know, it's all a little blunt. I get that. But while the media around the game has presented great inspiration, and I'm thrilled that it exists. I think it's very cool. It also, a lot of people come into it like, I want to have that experience. And it's like, you have to remember that in a lot of cases, they have changed the basics of D&D to be much more narrative focused, much less mechanically focused. Even Critical Role, which is live streamed, is a lot of role play. And there are, the standard game probably won't look like that. You know, there's just a lot of like waiting around. There's a lot of rules checking. There's a lot of dice rolling. There's a lot of, it's slow. There's a lot of people talking over each other. Most groups can't really handle that. And so while I don't think you should necessarily strive to be as good as that, because I think it takes a very specific group of people and it's very hard to find that kind of group of people and the people dedicated enough to do editing and all this kind of stuff, I think to some degree you should take it as example and say, well, why are they having fun? They're having fun because everyone gets a chance to participate. It's pretty clean. Everyone talks. Some jokes are thrown around, but not a million, not constantly. They invest themselves in the game. They create, we've talked about this, kind of a pseudo radio drama, right?
Yeah.
And the story is what carries it. But if you are a group, or you have a group that is always sort of jumping out to tell jokes, always disrupting the flow of play, always leaving people out intentionally or accidentally, you're never going to get there, because the professionalism involved with those really fun versions of the game are just that. They're really professional about every aspect of it. And so while I don't expect that from most parties, I would hope that you will consider saying, well, I don't get to have every moment in the spotlight because other people are here too. But I can still have some if I'm just conscientious about, you know, who's got a chance. You know, let's let somebody else, like, I don't want to take the reins every time, you know, like, let somebody else kind of have it for a while.
Well, and that's the thing is, like, you look at those professionally made D&D campaigns, and you're right, no table is ever going to run like that. Nor should you aim to run like that, I think. I think that, you know, what they do is fantastic, especially for Dungeons & Dragons as a game, for exposure, for pulling in new people, which is the most exciting thing. But I think that, at the end of the day, they look at that as the same way, you know, a couple of students in college who are trying to get something in Sundance look at making a film.
Yeah.
It is the same process. It is a creative endeavor to create a piece of media for others' enjoyment. Now, when you and your friends are gathering around your gaming table and you're playing Dungeons and Dragons, that is literally playing a game. So there is a different kind of dynamic. But there is still the importance of that same kind of etiquette. Like, you look at, like, a lot of times, a lot of the problems with, you know, people talking over each other, people derailing, people arguing, is, like, event X happens, and then one person reacts in a specific way to it, and everyone else didn't want that to be the reaction. Now, as someone who's played a rogue my entire life, the constant example of that is, oh, here's an opportunity to use stealth and subterfuge. Oh, wait, never mind. The fighter just ran in the front door. Okay, I guess we're doing this now. Yeah. And, like, that kind of thing is, that's not a good way to look at it. It's a lot more, like, oh, this is me playing my game when my friends are here. Yeah. But if you look at that opportunity, like, oh, the fighter charges in the front door as a rogue. Okay, so now that event is the new event I'm concentrated on. Yeah. Whatever triggered that in the first place is gone from my mind now, because that's less relevant than this fighter charging through the front door. Mm-hmm. Now I know that this is what I'm reacting to. So instead of being like, oh, no, 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 wait, don't do that, we should do this instead, I'm going to say, that happened, so now I'm going to use that as a diversion. And now I can sneak around, because the guards that were guarding the side door ran over to the commotion, and now I have an entrance. So, yeah,
that's a good idea. Also, just to jump back into the combat for a moment, like, DMs remember that just because some people are in combat doesn't mean everybody has to be in combat. So if, in this example, the fighter runs in and Scott's like, well, we were trying to get to the other room, and all of a sudden every guard in the fucking place just ran up to the front door. Like, if I can get around them, I mean, they have technically lessened the burden on me. And as long as, you know, the DM is fine with saying, like, all right, well, for Scott's round of combat, essentially I'll give him 2 minutes to tell me what he's going to do in that time. And that will be his turn, basically.
Well, and even if you keep in standard initiative, if you're not participating in the combat, it's still 6 seconds blobs, and you can still do skill checks in combat, and, like, you look at specifically rogues have abilities that make it easier to do skill checks in combat. So I feel like that's the intention of that, is like, all right, so while everyone's making a commotion at the front door, rogue is going to climb to the second story window and pick that lock. Mm-hmm. And he has advantage on climb checks, and his climb speed is increased, so he could do it in one turn, and he can use a bonus action to pick this lock in combat because he has this rogue thing. So now all of a sudden, the character functionality makes more sense, and everyone gets to do what they want.
Yeah, I wanna shift into the DM's perspective just a little bit and give a few pointers about how to maintain etiquette, what to do, because I tend to be a fairly kind of hands off DM. A lot of times I let players converse as they want to, do what they want to, and that I think that leads to certain levels of fun and certain levels of frustration. Right, there's always like this. Some things work for some reasons and they don't work for other reasons. You're always kind of playing the balancing act. So one of the things that always happens, because I can be very hands off, is people end up planning for way too long, you know?
Yeah.
And this has been like in any game I've ever run with any group of people I've ever run, you know, hands off DMing is great fun for sort of improv and role play stuff, but it also leads to these kind of exponential increases in how long it takes for anybody to come to a conclusion. And so one of the things that has been suggested to me by a friend was basically sort of a social turn order as a solution, saying like, okay, instead of everybody just having to talk at once, everybody rolls as if it were initiative and they get to say their piece in their time. And at the end, there's kind of you can almost call it like a vote, you know, like everyone's made their piece and everyone gets to react. And what are we going to do? And I also want to add to that is I thought of this, and I think this may have been suggested in some capacity as well, but I'd been thinking about this previously in another game I ran. One of the things I had was some people basically played a game of football. And I said, how is this going to work? This is kind of weird. There's no rules for this. But one of the things I did was instead of saying how many turns this is going to take, because that was so abstracted and it just seemed like it would take forever to do like a lot of turns, I said, this is going to run for one real time half hour. It doesn't matter how long it takes you to make a decision. It doesn't matter how long it takes a play to complete. I don't care how long it takes to figure out the dice. You're getting one half hour. That turned out not to be quite enough. I think I gave another like 15 or 20 minutes on top of that. But I learned that restraint actually made it more fun because people had to decide. They were like, we only have like 30 minutes in total.
You gotta be impulsive.
You have to be impulsive. And so in some way, you know, you say, okay, your plan is to go talk to the Baron, and you have to decide, or your plan is to go do something with the Baron. You haven't decided if you're going to kill him, talk to him, steal his stuff, whatever you want to do. I am determining as the DM, you have started to walk over there. you have 20 real-time minutes to decide what you're going to do when you get there. And once you arrive at that destination, literally the first person to say something is getting a yes. And it doesn't mean you have to follow along, but that means I am as a DM and I am as a gamekeeper not going to allow you to have unlimited time to decide, because it leads to just noise and confusion and argument and sometimes fun, but also it makes the game like 3 times longer. So it's like, All right, you have 10 minutes, 10 real-time minutes. Figure it out amongst yourselves. Once you arrive there, you need to make a decision. And if you haven't, the first person to do something gets a yes. From that point on, you're reacting to whatever catastrophe they bring upon you. I don't want to hear, oh, we shouldn't have done that. I don't care anymore.
And that's the thing is, I think that one of the best tools in the DM's arsenal in regards to people getting distracted or people pulling out or taking too long to talk is the NPC. Because if you have that situation where they're like, oh, we're going to the Baron's place and we're going to go meet with him, and they're talking about like, oh, we can meet with him and see if he'll help us, and then someone in the party, it keeps derailing the conversation by saying like, oh, why don't we just sneak in the back and steal the thing that we need? All you have to do is take the affectation of a guard and say, wait, what are you going to steal? And all of a sudden, it's done. No one is planning anymore. Everyone is pulled into the game like, no. He was joking. Like, it's not a big deal. So using that as like, because it's not technically metagaming, but it's close. Not even close. It's still like in character, but it's something that does suck a lot. It's a time vampire. It pulls the game on. So it's the kind of thing where like, that is something that's important to like remind your players that they are in a world. They are not just thinking about this stuff. They're supposed to be role playing it. So like, the other thing is if they have a very specific quest and they know it beforehand, I give them a research phase and they can like go try to find out stuff about it, and then they could plan. And then I'm just like, okay, you guys are leaving now for your quest. You have made your plan. Yeah. That is the only plan you get. If it changes, which it will, don't get to discuss it. It has to be reactionary because you already have your plan.
Yeah.
And doing stuff like that to kind of limit them in the planning. Because, like, honestly, if you let your players go on and on permanently, they will spend 4 out of your 5-hour game, or 3 out of your 4-hour game, or 2.5 out of your 3-hour game, so on and so forth. They'll spend most of the game arguing over the minutiae of these mundane decisions that, based on what you planned, might not even be that consequential. Yeah. And there's nothing you can do about it, because if you say, like, guys, this doesn't really matter, it ruins the, you know, game, because all of a sudden, like, they're pulled out of it. They're like, oh, if this doesn't matter, I don't care, we just do this thing and move on.
Yeah.
I think with that, though, I mentioned metagaming, and the other thing that, I mean, has happened to me in the past, and does happen in the past, especially, well, specifically with experienced characters, and it's something that I myself, as a player, have been guilty of, and have had to curb myself on. Oh, I know this enemy, I know what will be good against it. And, like, if your character didn't do a knowledge roll and doesn't have that information, they wouldn't know that. Like, your character would not know. I mean, I don't think this is a thing in 5e, but it was in 3.5. Skeletons are resistant or immune to piercing damage and slashing damage.
And still, trolls still regenerate if you don't burn the wound.
Exactly. So, like, things like that, you wouldn't know. So, well, you know what I'll do if someone mentions that to the party? Like, oh, yeah, guys, use blunt weapons on these skeletons. And they aren't a cleric or have any knowledge on undead or anything like that. I'll just take away that. I'll just switch it and not tell them. And all of a sudden,
like, that's what you do. It's like, they're like, blunt weapons. Like, no, these skeletons are really susceptible to arrows. How weird, huh?
these are the blunt weapon resistant skeletons. Yeah, they do not take blunt damage.
These are flush skeletons, which I think is just people.
These trolls actually regenerate if you don't freeze the wounds.
Yeah.
Whoops.
These trolls don't regenerate at all. They lose health and they're vampires and they're coming for you because you pissed me off.
Exactly. Well, and that's the thing is, like, because I've seen a lot of different, like, metagaming punishments in my day. I've seen One that actually, like, I mean, it was a little ham-handed, but it did work, was I had one DM back in the day, actually my first DM, whenever anyone pulled out of character, and he was very strict with this, whenever you dropped character at all, he would, we were in a city, and a brick would fall on your head.
Oh, I remember
that. And do one, it would do 1d4 damage to you, and yeah. Not non-lethal, it would literally do damage. So if you started, like, trying the metagame, or you started talking out of character, or you weren't paying attention, you got bricked. And
you got bricked.
I mean, it got to the point where one of our characters' nicknames was Brick, because it happened so many times to him, because he just couldn't get past it. And so it's the kind of thing where, like, you can create, you know, I like to think of incentives rather than punishments for things.
Yeah,
so
incentives are, psychologically speaking, a far more compelling reason to do something. Well,
and that's what inspiration is. And that's why
yes,
it exists.
Yes, yes, yes.
So
I wish you could get more than one, because I feel like that's the only big drawback with that, is once you have the one, it's like, well, it doesn't matter anymore. So I would be willing to say you can get multiples, but then you run that risk of people like, oh, I have 14 inspiration, I'm going to reroll everything. It's like, ah, shit.
Well, see, that's the thing, is the way I normally run it is every player starts with one unusable inspiration that they can award to any other player.
Oh, I see.
And inspiration resets at every session. So, like, if, you know, Mark thinks that Tom did a really, really cool thing, roleplayed really well, or did something rad, he can give his inspiration over, and then that guy has inspiration for the rest of the game. Or if Sally was just like, oh, you really did a good job not metagaming at that point, Tom, here's an inspiration. So everyone has one inspiration to award throughout the session.
Right, right.
So that way, it has players incentivizing each other.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea, and I think that as a further point on from a DM's perspective, I just want to say, and we've mentioned this a million times. I mean, this is really, I think at this point, clear. But I want to emphasize again that as a DM, even if you have a story to tell and it's specific and your players aren't necessarily doing what you want them to do or what you expect them to do or what is cohesive with this the narrative as you've laid it out, it is kind to allow them to have some fun in the way that they want to have it and run the characters as they want to run them. Now, obviously, at the beginning, you reserve the right to veto things that will be outwardly problematic for one reason or another. And not even problematic, as we used it earlier in this episode, but just, like, you're going to have a hell of a time doing this in this setting. Like, it's just going to be, like, functionally impossible for one reason or another. But I think a lot of times it can be very easy to say, like, no, that's frustrating. Like, what are you doing that for? Like, that's crazy. And I think that sometimes players forget it's a game, and they forget to move it along, and they forget to, like, stay in character. And I think sometimes they remember so well that DMs weren't expecting it, and that they're saying, like, no, like, it's a game. I'm going to have, like, a lot of fun. I'm going to, like, really dig in and be kind of, like, I'm going to be into it. And sometimes you have these weird psychologies that come with odd characters, and it pays to allow those to run free to some extent. We've obviously mentioned that sometimes you let them run too free and they don't come back, you know, but to some extent, you know, give them some parameters, give them time limits, give them saying, like, you have to either decide this or this. You either have to kill this person. Like, there's really no maybe middle ground in some cases where you have to come up with a very clever third solution. But within that, you know, let them say, well, what if we don't just stab the person, we arrange to have a piano dropped on her head, you know, at this time, you know. It's like, why not? You know, it's like, you know what, that sounds fun to you, go for it. I'm getting what I want, you're getting what you want, we're meeting in the middle, it's about the compromise. And that is, I think, the biggest sort of point about the interpersonal etiquette, is it's always going to be about the compromise. Is you're playing with many people in many different roles at many different experience levels from many different places. You're going to have to give. If you don't want to give, play a game that has more stringent rules, or play a solo game. because this is a very, very, very social multiplayer game.
Yes.
And there's no amount of bitching and moaning and throwing yourself into the front that's going to change the nature of the game, because even if you're having the best time, if you're taking up all the room, someone else is not. And that's not fair to them, because they showed up for the same reason you did.
Exactly. Well, and we are running close to our end time here, though. Yeah,
we've crossed actually.
we've crossed it. But there is one more point that we have not made yet that I do definitely want to make in this episode in regards to etiquette. Which is, we talked about, you know, choices in character building and, like, you know, honestly, most of y'all know better, so this shouldn't be an issue, but, like, you know, a lot of people talk about, oh, well, it's not racist if I do this accent because this person is... Oh my god,
we totally forgot about this, you're right.
Yeah, so this person is a representative of that culture, and, again, calling bullshit on that. Like, it's a load of crap. First off, every race, every person, every creature, every NPC in Dungeons & Dragons is fantasy. They do not exist in our world, so there is no nationalities that cross over. There is no such thing as any nationality or culture or race or language or anything that exists in our world that also exists in Dungeons & Dragons. So, there is no reason that you should ever feel obligated to use a specific race's affectations, language, accent, or anything like that, especially a parody of those accents. Yeah. That comes back to, you know, respect and intent. And if your intent in giving a NPC a specific accent is to use that accent to demonstrate that they are silly or dumb or bad in some way, that's fucked up. Because that is ascribing that characteristic to an entire race of real human beings that aren't in your fantasy world.
Yeah.
So, again, you should know better.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah, go for it. No, you got
it. Oh, no, that's all you.
Okay. Were you going to talk about sort of ways to give the... Because I was going to talk about the ways that you can use other kinds of vocal affectations to
reach... Fire away.
Yeah, so... I was... When we were... talking about this episode before recording, we had a conversation, and obviously we're not saying we have found the solution to all, you know, but we came across the issue of well, if you don't want to make it, especially if you run the adventures, the pre-made adventures that Wizards puts out, a lot of those, like, country hop and continent hop a lot. Mm-hmm. So it makes logical sense that someone from this continent wouldn't necessarily sound the same as someone from this continent. That makes perfect sense. But as a DM and possibly as a player, you're sitting there going, well, they won't sound the same. What do I do? Because I don't want to just sort of, as the phrase goes, whitewash it, though it could be anything wash it. I don't want to just say, like, well, they just sound like this, too, because that is somehow, like, well, that's not even accurate. If nothing else, it's just, like, it's probably doesn't really make sense. You lose a lot of tonality of whatever this new place is. But you also don't want to basically become Apu from The Simpsons. So where do you sit, right? And I think what we decided was, A, this isn't a perfect solution. We recognize that. A, with any given group of people, there's a number of vocal affectations. I think Scott was saying, like, in God's Fall, Draconic is like Valley Girl. You know, that sort of, mm-hmm, like,
it's,
oh,
great,
my God! And that's Draconic. And that's possibly associated with a specific race of people, a group of people. But for some people, that's not going to be an appropriative gesture to do. And in your given life, like, I come from a Jewish family, and I know a lot of my family members that I wouldn't really be impersonating, like, Jews as much as I'd be impersonating, like, yeah, this is what, like, my cousin's grandfather sounds like when he talks. This is my grandfather. This is my aunt. This is, you know, these kinds of things. And using even sometimes your friends, the people at the table, because they're not using their own voices, so you might as well snag them. I know I've done this, but there's things like that. There's not always a lot of them, but depending on who you know and who your family is and sort of who you are, you may have more or less to that. The thing that is possibly much more helpful and that has much, probably infinite variety, is giving a person a specific mode of speech. And by that, I mean, we were talking, not to mention it for the 100,000th time, but Pratchett will do this. A lot of authors do this. A lot of authors do this, but in him, what I find is that if he's trying to get across a specific mode of speech, what he'll do is, like, there's a general in the books, or a military officer, high-ranking military officer, who ends all of his sentences with what? You know, so it's like, we're going down to the good, what? You know? And it's sort of a gag, because a lot of old military types have that kind of, like, what? Kind of thing. and that's not necessarily, like, that's not attributed to a race, it's not, like, a dialect. It's a vocal tic. It's one of those things we all do. I say a lot. Scott says, like, that's the thing. You know, I had a teacher who used to say kind of a thing after every... He's like, it would be a this kind of a thing. It's a this kind of a thing. Everything he said was always like that. And so I think that there's ways to add phrases at the end of sentences. Say, like, oh, the people of this culture, to kind of denote they speak differently... They end their sentences with this phrase. Is it literal? Probably not. But is it tonal? And it gets across that you're speaking with somebody who speaks differently than you? Yes. There's some room, possibly, if you're thinking about real culture, you have to be, like, amazingly careful with this. But if you think about it broadly, there are some cultures that romance languages, for example, they will gender... a lot of things. Nouns get gendered, for example. And so you have perhaps this group of people will, they don't use it, they use his or her or any number of other gendering terms that you'd like to use. So in this case, it's like, well, they're not necessarily, I'm not putting on like an accent, but what I am doing is I'm saying like, they gender their nouns. Or I know that I've known a couple people who are from Eastern Europe, Czechoslovakia, Prague. I think Prague is Eastern Europe. I believe it is.
Yes.
Russia, that's Asia. Things like that. And in some of those languages, like, articles aren't exactly a thing. So one person I can think of specifically never really got the hang of the and a. And those kinds of things. So, you know, I'm going to bowling alley. I'm driving car. Because in her language, they really didn't use articles like that. So that's a sort of thing like, well, in this language, they don't use, you know, they don't use articles or they don't use plurals. Everything is singular. They only speak in the present tense all the time. You know, things like that. You can take broader aspects of languages, because I don't expect everybody to basically invent a new language system every time they travel. I mean, that would be like really difficult,
but it would be really cool.
It would be cool, but taking language systems and studying, be like, what are the little ticks of this language? And like, you know, it doesn't use articles. It genders its nouns. It doesn't use clauses. It only uses like one subject, one verb sentences. It doesn't have proper nouns, something like that. It only speaks present tense. Those are other ways that you can get at a difference in dialect, a tonal aspect for an area, without having to jump into questionable at best social interactions. Yeah. I'll phrase it that way.
And this is something I talked about with the when we did the NPCs episode and stuff like that. I am comfortable doing a couple specific accents, first off because I do them poorly enough that they're not an accurate parody or making fun of. Like, I on the inside know the accent I am trying to do. When I do it on the outside, no one does. So this is the difference.
It's not actually indicative of anybody.
Exactly. It's not a real person's accent. It only exists in my brain, so thus it's become a fantasy accent. Also, like, low-hanging fruit is totally an option. Like, if... what are the snake people called?
Oh, the, oh, God, Scott.
I'm sorry.
The Yuan-Ti.
The Yuan-Ti. Like, how about just putting a buttload of extra S's in every S word?
They go out of their way to use only words that have S's if they can help it.
Just alliteration involving S's always. Yeah. And, like, that's not only, like, low-hanging fruit, not gonna hurt anyone. That's, like, not gonna offend anyone.
Yeah. I mean, also, if a snake person shows up at your game, we'll take full responsibility for the offense that you commit. But it's doubtful that will happen.
Exactly. And also, like, that's funny, and, like, that character is definitely gonna be someone they remember.
Yeah.
There's a Patton Oswalt joke about, you know, the certain accent of, like, using, like, a lot of B's and having, like, bouncing B's.
Yeah.
And, like, I mean, honestly, it's in poor taste because it's kind of, like, fucked up towards, like, heavier people. But, like, I think that picking a certain letter in an accent to, like, really hone in on changes the way people hear you and the way you speak a lot, which can really make a lot of difference.
Absolutely. Or just, like you know, there's... This is a linguistics thing, and, you know, if you don't know linguistics in any way, it's, you know, harder to do. But, you know, emphasizing, like, there's no short A's. There's no, like, cat. There's only cot. You know, it's all long A's in this language. It's all sort of...
Cot.
That's so dumb. That's such a bad idea.
I have a pet cot. Oh, wait, would they do the E's too? So it'd be a peat cot.
Yeah, that would be almost inscrutable. That would be a very difficult language to do and understand. However, there's ways you can... The point of it is you can do affected character voices without crossing hurtful lines, is my point. Is, you know, take your fantasy races and recognize that, like, no one's going to be pissed if you're imitating a talking jackal, you know? and that you can, instead of saying, you know, make up vocal tics, basically.
Yeah.
Or use ones they're not, like, offensive, you know, like gendering your nouns is not gonna, like, piss anybody off. You can be like, well, no, I based it on, like, romance languages. Like, it's kind of a romance language thing. It's not like, doesn't this sound stupid?
Yeah, exactly. And, like, I used to have a lisp, so, like, that's something I used to have trouble with, actually, a lot of specific letters. Yeah, I used to pronounce my name Scott.
Then
My last name was Witwaw because I couldn't think ER. Yeah. So, like,
way.
Yeah. That's the kind of thing where, like, I've never personally done it. And because, like, that's where a line is as far as I'm concerned. Like, I wouldn't do that because that's fucked up. Not okay to, like, take something that it was a speech impediment that I don't think of it as a trauma. Like, I went to speech therapy in elementary school and now I'm better at S's and R's, but, like, it's not the kind of thing that I would use as a character trait. And, like, I think that in regards to that, like, it's really easy to fall into tropes that exist in popular media very quickly for specific tokenized characters.
Yeah, if it's on a major channel sitcom, it's probably not okay.
Exactly. It's the kind of thing where, like, oh, well, if MSNBC does it, it must be fine, and it's not. And, like, I think that there is so much that you can do with your vocal cords, with your writing, with your creativity, with your improv, aside from depending on, like, tired, bigoted, problematic tropes that exist in modern media, mm-hmm. that, like, it's honestly lazy to use them, and I get it, like, not everyone puts as much time into being a DM as I am, but, like, that's not only lazy, it's hurtful, it's hurtful, and you can't even take the time to, like, or put the effort in to make your campaign not hurtful. It's, like, salt on the wounds situation.
Yeah, as a player, I would rather you just don't do a voice than do that kind of voice. You just say, like, this is what they say.
That's the other option that's, like, always there, because we talk a lot about doing character voices because we do them. That's not obligatory. Yeah. You can totally just be like, oh, this person kind of has, like, a dark and mysterious accent, and they say this. And speaking in the third person instead of the first person as a DM puts you in more of a narrator role,
yeah.
But it allows you to, like, you know, not have to worry about coming up with 36 funny accents or fun accents or interesting accents for all your NPCs.
Yeah. I want to just throw this last thing out there. I know this episode's running a little long. But it seems like the appropriate time to do it. So one of the things that I frequently do, because I check our SoundCloud, like, many times a day. I don't know, I'm just obsessive about it. And one of the things that I love more than anything else is that you can get, for those of you who have never seen this page, there's a stats page that shows you, like, how many views on what uploads. And one of the other things is where those uploads are coming, where those listens are coming from, specifically countries and down to cities. And I am constantly flabbergasted and, like, struck right in the heart when I look at the countries that have listened to us. Because when we started this, like, Scott and I started this because we were having these conversations anyway. We were talking about, like, DMing all the time, and we said, like, we should just record this and see if it's good for anybody. And, like, you know, at the outset, like, I said, man, if I got, like, 500 listens on this whole thing, I'd be stoked, right? And already we've crossed 1,000, we're into 1,100, we're aiming towards 1,200 almost. Like, we're actually getting a lot of views, and I'm not saying that to brag, I'm saying that because I didn't anticipate it being as consistently sort of enjoyed as it turned out to be, and consistently enjoyed, like, in all these parts of the world. I can't read all of them, but, like, you know, the United States is, like, the one we get the most, but, like, the second one is, like, Canada, Australia, the Netherlands, Sweden, United Kingdom, Germany, New Zealand, Mexico, Peru. We've had hits from, like, South Africa, Turkey, India, Iceland, Singapore, Spain, Estonia, Japan, Saudi Arabia. Like, all over the world, we've managed to get at least, like, one listen, if not, like, 100 plus listens. And I just am, like, constantly, constantly in love with how broad the listeners are, because it makes it feel so much more important that way, because it is advice, it is entertainment, perhaps, that extends beyond our immediate sphere. And I think for people who make things as we do, that's the hope, I think. I mean, it's so exciting for me to be like, oh my God, like, we always get hits from, like, Sweden. I'm just like, man, like, I would love to know who is listening. Like, who is this person? Like, who is our fan in Australia? Like, I gotta know, you know. And I may never, I probably will never, but I adore that. I adore that very much. It makes me so happy. And so it seemed like, given the nature of this episode, that this was probably the most appropriate time to bring this up. And just to say, to all our fans all over the world, like, thanks so much. Like, that's amazing, and I'm so appreciative for it.
Yeah, I do also want to say thank you, because it is, like Ben said, it was the kind of thing we started for, you know, we were just like, well, we're like hanging out, just the two of us talking about D&D for hours on end anyway, and, like, having these conversations for our own shits and giggles, and, like, figuring out this stuff as we talk about it. And we're like, we might as well, like, tell other people. And I honestly thought it was the kind of thing that, like, yeah, some people were going to listen, but mostly it was going to be up there for the sake of, like, personal posterity, so I could just be like, oh, yeah, this is my thoughts on this thing, and I did not expect, like, people to listen to it. So it's, like, really fucking validating to see people out there actually listening to what we have to say, and I do want to also say, looking at it now, it seems like our target for 1,000 listens turned out to be a little low. but we have surpassed it quite significantly, which means we are going to be probably around the holidays doing a video episode. Mm-hmm. Still in the planning phases. It's going to be something fun and exciting and extravaganza-esque, but we're not sure what it is yet.
There's going to be at least one party hat, I'll promise.
All right, so Ben's going to be wearing a party hat.
I might be wearing many party hats, we'll see.
All right, so Ben's going to wear a couple party hats. But, like, with that, we really have just a handful more episodes in the season. And then we're going to take a little bit of a hiatus before that live episode. So we have three more episodes, maybe four more that we're going to talk about. And then we're going to take a break probably until like late December when we do that live video. So it's probably going to be the season two kickoff is us, you know, doing a, going into a video format for that episode. But,
So, when we're on that break, you know, and when we're thinking of what we want to do the next season, because there's still so much in the game to talk about. I mean, we've been asked about like the Unearthed Arcana stuff, about the stuff in Volo's Guide, what to do with those things, what to do with supplementary materials. You know, we could talk some about how to use adventure modules, even though we're not terribly experienced. I do know how they're intended to be used, and we could talk about that. There's things we can do with season two, but we are very curious about your feedback. We want to know what you want to know, and we'll, you know, we'll help in the, any way we can. So feel free to drop us a line at dungeoncasterspodcast@gmail.com.
Or you can tweet at us at dungeon_casters. Mm-hmm. And yeah, we'll answer your tweets. We'll tweet you back. We'll do the whole tweet for retweet thing.
Oh yeah,
whatever you need.
We'll be real good about it. Also, we're on iTunes. You can search us under the podcast tab at Dungeon/Casters. If you'd be so kind, it'd be wonderful if you could leave us a rating and a review. It would really help us out.
So hey Ben,
Scott. You know, I wasn't sure if you had a joke prepared, I'll be honest, and I was fretting this entire time.
Do have a joke prepared.
Okay. It was hard to do without you. Yeah, it was hard. Last week I didn't have a joke.
Oh, did you do a joke last week?
No, I didn't. I didn't have a joke, so I just faded into blackness. I just faded into the void.
There's the inside scoop. I don't listen to our own podcast.
Scott, well, it was actually like a week ago, and you're a busy beaver.
Well, also, it's only because I wasn't on the episode. I only listen to episodes that I talk, and I actually only listen to my audio isolated. I never listen to what Ben says. But I do have a joke for you.
Okay. I want to know, Scott, tell me, what is
your joke? Hey, Ben.
Yes?
Why couldn't the warlock unlock his true potential?
You know, Scott, every week, you tell me the joke, and then I hear the answer. I'm like, it's so fucking obvious. Like, it was right there, and I never get it.
Mm-hmm.
And this week is not different. I don't know.
Well, he didn't have a war key.
What?
Warlock, war key?
Oh my god.
Oof. Ugh. Oof. Scott. That one took you a while to get there.
What is a war key? All right, I guess the joke's on me. I'm just a moron. All right. Noted. Scott, tell me simpler jokes. Maybe more kind of jokes next time. Maybe just cover your face and go peekaboo, and then I'll laugh and we can stop the episode.
In this podcast, we used Achilles and News Sting by Kevin MacLeod of Accompetech.com, licensed under Creative Commons.